I'm Mark Labberton, president of Fuller Theological Seminary. Welcome to Conversing. Welcome to Conversing. I'm really delighted today to welcome three colleagues and friends who are part of the worshiping community and the worshiping leadership at Fuller Seminary. And I've asked them if they would, for starters, just introduce themselves and give us a little picture of who they are and what they're doing more broadly, and then what their work is at Fuller. And then we're going to have a conversation about the great things that I think are happening in chapel at Fuller and the questions and opportunities and imagination that I think is triggered by what we're trying to do. So let me just invite you to begin.
Okay, I'll start. My name is Julie Tai. I'm the director of chapel here, and I'm also a born and raised LA gal. Born, raised, educated, everything LA. I'm second generation Korean American, born on the day my mother came to the US.
Wow.
Yes. Plane landed, went into labor, and I was born. So
oh my gosh.
My mom,
not on the plane.
Yeah, not on the plane. Yeah, she had a small stomach, so people just assumed she was only 6 months, but she was 9 months pregnant with me. So I've been here, and my mom's been here as long as I've been alive. So I was almost born on a plane. I'm a LA gal. I'm a foodie. I really love food in the LA scene. I think that's the same for January as well. So if you have any questions about that, it could be a separate one, separate whole conversation on conversing. And I've been deeply, deeply in love with the work of creating worship music and liturgy for my community. I didn't necessarily grow up having examples of worship that reflected the stories in my community. So I am obsessed with creating materials that I can leave behind for the next generation of Korean Americans and Asian Americans. I really don't care what they do with it. They can deconstruct it, critique it to death, get rid of it, but they'll have something to start with. So I'm obsessed with that. I spend all of my extra time thinking about that and creating a material for them. I'm also a UCLA grad. Woo! I graduated with a bachelor's degree in Asian American studies and also studied vocal jazz there. So I have a jazz background, but mostly what I do today is worship. And so, yeah, that's me.
Great. Thanks.
My name is Aaron Dorsey. I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago and in a mixed family. So I'm African American, but then my mom is from England. And so I have always been navigating multiple spheres, multiple cultural legacies that I've kind of inherited. But I think my role here is really as a musician. And it's funny, I learned this story recently from my great uncle. I did not know this until a couple of months ago. He said he came over. I was living outside DC at that particular point in time, 2 years old. And he was like, most 2 year olds are running around, freaking out, doing whatever. Mm-hmm. He was like, your mom put on a Sade concert, a 2 hour long Sade concert. He's like, had you stopped talking, you stopped moving, you sat down and you watched the entire thing.
Wow.
And he was like, that was from the moment, and I still, to this day, love Sade. And it's funny, because when he told me that, I was like, oh, that makes so much sense. Mm-hmm. I think that music has always been a thing that I've connected to, and it's something that is essential to me, regardless of how its position in the church ebbs and flows, its priority, its de-priority, mm-hmm. issues of performance versus authenticity, all that comes and goes. But for me, either way, I find myself looking towards musicians, and that's especially the way that I connect with my own Black heritage. Mm-hmm. And that's what I feel like I bring to me as I came to Fuller as a student first and now as a chapel assistant after I've graduated. And my role has been to participate in the team in that way.
Great. Thanks. January, tell us your story.
Hi, my name is January Lim, and a little bit of a story behind my name. Right before I was born, my dad watched a movie, and in it, there was a pilot who sacrificed his life for his passengers and crew. His name was Captain January, and I looked it up on IMDb. There is a Shirley Temple movie, actually, but it's not based on that, so there is a mystery. Nobody knows why my name is January, but I am a second-generation Korean-American. I was born in Portland, Oregon, but when I was four, my dad moved to the Bay Area, San Jose, California, to pursue ministry. And I come from a wide kind of heritage of pastors. So my uncle, my grandfather, and my dad were all pastors serving at their own separate churches, home churches, all within a 30-mile radius in the Silicon Valley. So all I knew growing up was church, school, because it was the Silicon Valley and everything was super competitive academically. And I also was trained classically on the violin. So I would go to the conservatories on weekends and do orchestra and chamber music and solfège classes and all that. So that's basically all I knew. And with the pressures of all of that, one way that I found to kind of diffuse that was by watching these black and white old classic musicals. My favorite is Judy Garland, to this day, the greatest entertainer of all time. But I would watch these musicals on the weekends because they were the only ones available at the library, which is one of the few places I was allowed to go on my own.
Wow.
So I had this kind of growing passion for film. And so when it came down to go to undergrad, I decided to pursue film and TV production. And unbeknownst to my parents, like, they had bred up this monster for film and storytelling. And so I went to college and, you know, kind of fast forward a lot of years later in 2008, I decided to move to LA to pursue acting. And my goal was to be in a movie with Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks, which already happened in the post, and I'm not in it. So that goes to show you I have a long ways to go. But that it's been like around 11 years, and sometime around 2-3 years ago, I really felt the Lord calling me into a space where it was like a holistic journey of my life coming together, a collision of the classical music training and background, but also the acting, the storytelling that I loved, as well as the anchor and the foundation I have in ministry with my family. And I felt that I found that through Brehm Center here at Fuller. And so currently I am studying to get my master's of theology and worship theology in the arts. And I'm also working as a chapel assistant. And I think my call truly as an artist is through whatever medium, whatever platform or avenue, is just to utilize the voice that someone has and to empower someone in their brokenness or in their rawness, just to tell it as it is, because I feel like in our unique individual paths, there's like so much we can learn from one another and truly impact. Like, I was impacted by films that were made 100 years ago, and this is why I'm here today. So I'm just really excited to pursue my creativity in all of these different ways.
Well, I just want to say what a great gift it is to have this conversation with each of you, because I have a very, very high regard for each of you and for the gifts that God's given you and for the way that you're trying to use them, certainly to serve Fuller. But I always have a sense that you have a much bigger vision than only what's happening at Fuller. And therefore, there's kind of a sense of the intensity of your presence here and what we're doing, but it's always mapped against a bigger picture of what Fuller is in its reach and also the kind of churches all around the world that in some way or another are fed or challenged or in conversation in one way or another with Fuller. So I'm very, very grateful for your contributions. I wonder if each of you could share, before we go on to talk about what you do here, give us one or two windows into experiences of worship that you've felt been most defining to you about what you seek and desire or have known through worship.
Yeah, I've had a lot of different experiences growing up that would speak to that. I have a very colorful denominational past. Grew up Pentecostal Roman Catholic, ended up at a Protestant Presbyterian church that was charismatic, and then went back to being like staunchly Presbyterian, and then went back to being charismatic at some point. I've church planted twice, and they've both kind of landed in different denominations. I just have like a lot of experiences in the past that led me to where I am today. Mm-hmm. And I have deep appreciation for the different gifts that each denomination brings. I also have a great deal of love for the very different ways that people worship around the world. I would say more than anything, I would like to say that I wish I could share a moment that really changed everything for me. I would say it's a series of moments. Mm-hmm. I've had a lot of really wonderful experiences, but I think the ones that has truly shaped me and changed me are the ones that really deeply hurt. Mm. So I mentioned earlier that I didn't grow up with liturgy and worship that reflected the stories of my community. And actually, I spent a lot of time in Korean American contexts, but that would do worship that was incredibly white evangelical. Mm. And it was such a strange disconnect because I felt there was so much beauty and especially a lot of lament that was coming out of my community. And yet it wouldn't reflect on a Sunday. Mm-hmm. And that disconnect was the thing that actually brought me to Fuller to pursue my degree. I just really wanted to know what was happening, what happens in communities, and then why is it that on Sundays in certain churches, even though demographically they're all, for me, it was all Korean Americans, the worship looks nothing like the things that was happening that resemble our community and the stories that were emerging out of our communities. So that disconnect kind of brought me here to figure out, Lord, what's happening? And is there a way to bridge that? Is there new worship that needs to emerge in order to have someone like me feel at home on a Sunday morning worship? Mm-hmm. And that doesn't necessarily always have to happen in a homogenous Korean American context, but especially there, shouldn't it? So a lot of that is the questions that have really colored the way that I think about worship and the way that worship is done here for at Fuller is multicultural and it's multi-denominational, but it's probably unique in that there isn't this every week we have, you know, Quaker worship or the next week it's Kenyan worship. It's really that it's this mixture of bits and pieces of the diversity around the world all in one service. Because if we're going to talk about communities that are really living into lament deeply, we need to borrow from Koreans and Korean Americans. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to think about celebration in the midst of pain, we need to think about worship that's coming out of the African American context. So all of these things exist in one service.
Right.
And we're really just taking pieces of the beauty that comes out of all these different communities and putting them in one service cohesively.
Right.
Cohesively
is a key.
Is key. Because transitions and tone and all those things matter. And we obsess over that when we meet to discuss how we plan. But those are all things that I think constantly about. And also, another big thing for me is, can justice be done in a worship space? I don't know if people are asking that as much. I think we're thinking about justice in the ways of getting out to the world. And this is important. I'm not degrading this. Going out into the world and getting your hands dirty and working and loving people in different spaces and places, that's important. But justice could also be done on Sundays in worship. And we're trying to discover what that looks like and how that's done well. And discovering what the language around that might be, the music around that might be, the art and experience around that might be. And we're really just trying to discover that together.
Right. Well, it shows. We'll come back to that in just a second.
Yeah.
Others.
So there are two major moments that I think were transformative for me or helped give me a window into what worship was for me. And the first was the first time I heard a Fred Hammond song. At that particular point in time, I was in actually in the majority white evangelical church. I heard this song one Sunday, the band's playing it, and I was just arrested by it. And it wasn't the lyrics, it wasn't the words, because I didn't learn the words so a couple years down the road. Mm. It was the chord progression.
Mm.
Because for me, the chord progression sounded like Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
That was what communicated to me who God was at that moment. And so it wasn't until, you know, there wasn't Spotify or anything, so I had to wait a couple more weeks to hear it again.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear it again. It's the same moment. I remember where I'm standing in this. It's actually like, it was like a salmon color carpet in this, which is an ugly carpet that should have never existed at this church. I remember where I'm standing. And I think, tears down my face. I'm 9 or 10 years old.
Mm.
And something about this has just communicated to me who God is.
Mm-hmm.
That just captured me. That captured me. The second moment for me was I was playing guitar for this gospel artist, and he was in the middle of promoting and letting people know about an album that he had just finished recording. And when he got a chance, he'd go with the full band, but on certain gigs, it would be more appropriate mm-hmm. to just have an acoustic guitar. Mm-hmm. So I was playing acoustic guitar for him. And we were playing in a conference room for, I want to say it was Ebony Magazine. And we're in this conference room leading worship. It's me playing acoustic and then about four vocalists and a guest vocalist, yeah. who I believe his name was Brian. And we sing a couple songs. And then Brian mentions that there's a song that his church likes to sing that was on an earlier album. Mm-hmm. And he's like, can we sing that one? And the worship leader I'm with, Todd, he's like, yeah, of course. I don't know the song, but we're going to do the song. And so Todd finds a way to communicate to me real quickly what the chords are that we're going to be going. It's just like kind of a different way of communicating it. And so mm-hmm. I start playing, he starts singing, his background vocalist starts singing, and it was already powerful at that moment. It was about God being unwilling to leave you.
Right.
And so that was already important, but then Brian started singing and it just about, now it probably did, it brought me to tears at that moment. Mm-hmm. And it was, I think, because as he started singing, as he said, this was something that mattered in his congregation. Mm-hmm. And it was as if he had brought them with him right. when he started singing.
Right.
And so the pain that this song was about, the perseverance that this song was about, mm-hmm. was brought into the room right. when he began.
Yeah.
And it was this texture
yeah.
to his voice that to me, again, it communicated something mm-hmm. about the nature of God's love, mm-hmm. not being a kind of cute love or like not being sentimental. Mm-hmm. It was raspy, it was gritty,
mm-hmm.
But it was still just as fervent. And both of those experiences kind of opened up my eyes mm-hmm. to the multitude of ways that worship communicates and that worship is a vehicle for drawing people mm-hmm. into God's presence. Because for me, it was a chord progression and a texture
right.
that I heard and that moved me to praising God. And so, yeah, those are...
I love the phrase that you used about it sounded like Jesus mm-hmm. To you. I realize I'm not going to ask you to sing the chord progression, but tell us what was being evoked that made it seem as though that was what Jesus would sound like somehow.
The chord progression is interesting. It is... This is a musical term. It's very chromatic. It was, I'm trying to think of how to describe it. It's the kind of sound, like if you could think about it as food, mm-hmm. it's the kind of food that you want to sink your teeth into. Mm-hmm. There was a depth and a richness to yeah. it. It wasn't minor or major, mm-hmm. to be honest. It very much existed in the middle of that mm-hmm. space.
That's good.
And it was this constant kind of tension and resolve, but not really a full resolve, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. but it had this mm-hmm. motion to it
yeah.
that to this day, it still resonates. Right. And it's one chord progression the whole way through.
Wow.
So it could go on. It could go on for 10 to 12 minutes.
And I'm not, it certainly
and I'm
does.
Still not done. Yeah. I'm still not done.
That was a warm up. Yeah.
Amazing.
And it just grabbed me in that mm-hmm. way. And it was, yeah, for me, just powerful. It's probably not notes that I would always hear. It mm-hmm. wasn't classic mm-hmm. four-chord worship song or anything sure. like that. But it wasn't just complex for the sake of it. It had this beauty and this elegance
right.
to it.
Mm-hmm. Right, something you could sink your teeth in is not an easy thing to come by.
Yes, mm-hmm. exactly.
That's a big deal.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so many snapshots that I have of worship. But I think the first couple that came up into my mind, one was in 2011, I had an opportunity to go to China on a short-term mission trip. And there was a small group of us because we were attending a string of small underground churches held at different apartments and homes for security's sake. And the first day that we had arrived, all of us were jet-lagged. There was maybe five of us from that team, and we were incredibly jet-lagged. We were a little scared because we had no idea what to encounter and what to expect, what we could give even, what we could offer. Language-wise, there was such a huge barrier. We needed translators the entire time. But immediately, we were ushered into a Sunday worship. It was a Sunday when we got there. And one acoustic guitar, not plugged in, no mics, just because you couldn't. People were asked to sing softly. So if you can imagine, dynamically, people are singing on mezzo pianos the entire time. But their hands are raised up in the air. Their faces are scrunched up in passion. There's like tears rolling down. And I was kind of glancing around being like, what is going on? And these people are literally crying in their souls, but they can't make noise. They're singing this song that it was not recognizable to us. It was a Chinese, original Chinese worship song, a gospel song. And for whatever reason, I was in that moment very incredibly humbled and privileged to be in that space of authentic worship. And I had to imagine in the very early church times, like this is something what it could have looked like, you know? And it was, to this day, I kind of have that snapshot of that mezzo piano worship of souls crying out to Jesus in a language that I recognized but could not speak. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I was forced to just receive and witness and observe and be floored by that. Mm. That was incredible. And another one, it's kind of like what Julie touched on, in not so much of a positive sense, but in an absence. This was part of my journey of being called to Fuller. There was a string of revival gatherings that was happening in Los Angeles. At that time, there was a huge, I guess, pleading for revival, if you will. And without mentioning any names, there was a huge tour being conducted by a very charismatic, very famous church worship band. And I went to this gathering, and, you know, as far as charismatic gathering goes, people were, you know, manifesting on stage and singing on top of their lungs. And I had to close my eyes to not get distracted, that kind of worship space. And it was all great. And all I saw on that stage was wonderful worship that was happening, brilliant musicianship, incredibly powerful, and all white people. And for a blitz second, I saw, at that time I was a redhead, currently I'm blonde, but at that time I was redheaded, and I saw a redheaded violinist in a corner of that stage. And I caught myself envisioning that. And I was like, whoa, what was that all about? Was that pride? Was that disillusionment? Was that feeling either antagonized or marginalized? Or was that an invitation? Like, I really had to kind of, in that split second, catch myself and let that moment hover in, like, my spirit. And I had a very quick tete-a-tete with God in that moment of, like, what is this, God? Is this a calling? Is this, again, an invitation? Is this a cause? And I think in that moment, in that conversation, I recognized a need to have specifically, for me anyway, Korean-American women leading worship and doing it in an empowered, free, victorious way that was not in a corner, hidden someplace, or kind of marginalized or cast aside in a specific niche, but a part of the main stage and in the spotlight. And that it was not necessarily a bad thing to want that even, that it could be a godly, holy thing to represent and stand for. And so that, in a sense, really caused me to then seek out different platforms, which led to, I guess, my last thing that I share, which led me to Fuller. And I still, I always share this with this chapel team, but I remember the first chapel service I went to at Fuller. It was a festival of beginnings or something like that. And I saw, first of all, on stage, incredible diversity, just in terms of color of skin and also demographics. And I saw in that program, incredible spectrum of genre of music. But then I heard the doxology being sung simultaneously in Korean, Spanish, and English. And I was just floored because it scratched something that I didn't know that I had. It scratched a hunger and touched on something that it could be done. See, like, people can do this, you know? Like, it doesn't have to be just a dream or abstract. This can tangibly be done, and it could be so moving, and it could shake literally the grounds of the earth for the people who are standing there. And I was blown away by the season that I was entering into that was like, I was seeing this actually happening. So, yeah.
Amazing. You know, one of the things that strikes me about what each of you have shared has been that it's about corporate worship, it's about public worship, it's about things that happen. I love this image of both soft and loud, classical and charismatic and Pentecostal and gospel and all of the various things that could be woven. So the genres can be incredibly mixed up. But it really has to do consistently with something about God and something with about the people of God experiencing God together in the context of worship. And one of the things that I think when we talk about worship in this conversation, one of the things that listeners perhaps should need to know is that Fuller is a place that has a very wide array of students, 120 denominations, so incredibly varied types of church styles and backgrounds and liturgical and non-liturgical, high church, low church, in between church kind of stuff. And then quite an array of international
populations, so 90 countries or so represented in the student body. So when we get together in chapel, which is a chapel that's deliberately for students and faculty and staff, we are coming together as a community that never has as much diversity as we still want, mm-hmm. but it is a lot more diversity than the average church congregation still often has. And in that setting, we've been working hard at trying to be sure that we're giving voice so that as many people find themselves in this service and find God in the services that we do in ways that are continuously being recreated, reinvented, designed intentionally, and given enormous care and thoughtfulness around how it's done, and yet an amazing array of forms and styles and all that, which is partly what I want us to talk about. So, because it's possible to come to that and just think, well, what we should really do is just offer an incredibly rich worship smorgasbord where we're just going to keep laying it out with mm-hmm. as many different kinds of foods as it were as possible and just say snack at will and get what you want out of this. And I want to say to the listeners, that's just exactly what doesn't happen.
Yeah. It's
not that. It's much more shaped and deliberate than that, but it is also incredibly varied. So mm-hmm. I'm just curious, as you each come, I just want you to think with those who are listening to this, you come to a given week, you know, often, certainly, perhaps the person that's going to speak and what it is that they may be planning to speak about. You know things about what's happening on campus in the world. You know mm-hmm. what the issues are that people might be grappling with. Give people a feeling as members of it, of this worship team, and includes a number of other people as well. When you come together and you begin to do that organic work of discerning, what should it be? What are the questions and things that you're trying to satisfy and raise?
I have to think about that for a second before.
Because we negotiate a lot.
Yes, we do.
Indeed. Yeah.
I mean, I think there are so many questions that get raised at any given point in time. Number one, I think the most crucial thing is that we actually start planning chapels a month ahead. Mm-hmm. I think that's important and that's significant to this conversation. Because I think that any time that you're on the time crunch, you don't have the time for the mm-hmm. kind of intentionality that our chapels take. Mm-hmm. When you don't have time, you will go to default, mm-hmm. wherever default is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So mine would be, let's start with four songs, let's read the scripture, sermon,
response,
goes on for as long as it needs to go and we're out.
Right.
Yep.
Like,
right. Very formulaic.
Yes.
Right.
That's like, if I don't have time, that's what's gonna happen. Yeah. It takes an incredible amount of time. I'd say there's that. And then the second piece is, it has to be done in collaboration.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I don't think that I am able as an individual to offer the kind of varied yet cohesive experience. Mm-hmm. If it was like, Aaron, you sit down by yourself and put in one of these chapels, I just frankly couldn't do mm-hmm. it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because I only have my own experience to rely on. And right. so it's those two factors, because then what can happen is I could say I'm partnered with January or something like this, and we know we have this topic and we're each putting ideas out there. And so already we're navigating a space where there are multiple perspectives coming in. And so the process itself reflects the community it's for.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The process, you can't go from one person's vision to something that fits a multitude of perspectives. Mm-hmm. You can try as hard as you can, but really, if it's a multitude of perspectives you're dealing with, it's got to be a multitude in the planning mm-hmm. phase.
Right.
Too.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I think what we could end up in is a situation, you know, just thinking of particularly of, say, ethnic diversity. If I had to plan a Korean-American chapel, all I would have is, frankly, whatever shortlisted experiences I have that would more or less come out as stereotypes
right.
when I'm planning, because I don't have that many experiences to draw upon. The only way for that to work is for me to coordinate with somebody who actually is like, I come from this. Let me tell you about what I do,
right.
and let's work this out together. And so I think that those are the elements that, in mm-hmm. my mind, that are essential
right.
to even begin,
right.
to
right.
even begin the process.
So it's time, it's community, it's negotiation.
Yes.
It's being vulnerable in the context of all of that to have agreement and disagreement, presumably, and right. all the things that go along with that.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you do have to address, well, what is it that's going on mm-hmm. all around us? because we can have great intentions. We can look at the academic calendar and say, well, this is going to be Black History Month, or this is going to be culture care, or this is going to be whatnot. But what is a school, what is a seminary actually going through? Mm-hmm. What are some concerns that the faculty and staff and students actually have? Mm-hmm. And it's not just that, because then you got to look at our local zip codes, and you got to look at what's going on in our neighborhood, mm-hmm. what's going on in our city, what's going on actually in our nation, and then beyond that, God, what is it that you are doing? Mm-hmm. And so the simultaneous questioning that goes on in our meetings, it gets deep. Mm-hmm. It really does. It gets complicated. And then you have to deal with our own insecurities of like, is it possible for us to, am I worthy enough to even approach this topic? Mm-hmm. For example, mm-hmm. there's so many times where I feel like I don't care enough. Mm-hmm. And this is just me speaking personally. Like, I don't know enough, or I don't care enough about mm-hmm. what's going on. How could mm-hmm. I possibly plan a chapel regarding Black History Month? Mm-hmm. That's beyond me. And so this is where I think the chapel teamwork comes into play of like, mm-hmm. none of us are mm-hmm. truly worthy. None of us has the right answer. No one chapel is going to fulfill anyone's mm-hmm. necessity to find reconciliation mm-hmm. or newness. But we can certainly try and mm-hmm. provide space mm-hmm. to begin dialogue, to mm-hmm. begin having conversations. And when Julie is talking about how do you do justice within chapel services, it's like, how do we pick songs then that will really stir people to engage with, you know, their authentic struggles mm-hmm. and then actually relay those questions out loud, bring right. it to the surface. Right. How do you plan the liturgy so that there's actually not just singing involved, but you have moments of silence to reflect what's actually going inside of you, to take pause and rest in a given moment? Because gosh, we do not know how to rest mm-hmm. these days. And even in terms of when we have a speaker and we're kind of engaging back and forth, like, you know, President Lambert, I have sent you emails at 11 p.m. being like, you know, what do you think about the timing of this? It's like a constant dialogue of like, how do we work together mm-hmm. to provide this space? Are we right. all on the same page?
Right, right, right.
And with that, are we on the same page as with the Holy Spirit?
Right,
like,
right.
That's kind of important. So I think this is where it's just, mm-hmm. this is where the terror and the joy of being a part of this chapel team happens. Mm-hmm. And all of these questions are asked. And yeah. all of these are dissected, sometimes with no answers, mm-hmm. but with some sort of courage to try.
Right, yeah. exactly, yeah.
Yeah, when people often ask us, how do you guys do what you do? Or why do you do what you do? And what is it that you do? The what question, the best way I could describe our planning is, we're doing performance art by way of liturgy. We're creating experiences. We're helping tell a story. And that's very much how we plan. Our planning mm-hmm. process is storytelling. It really is thinking about critically how people are entering the room. What do we gift them with as mm. they leave? It's generous work mm. where it really is a pouring out and a generous giving of a gift. Sometimes that gift is hope. Sometimes that gift is joy in the midst of suffering. Sometimes that gift is lament. Whatever it is, we're thinking critically about, how do we think people are going to enter the space? Where are they coming from? Are they downtrodden, broken? Mm-hmm. Are they dealing with illnesses that don't seem to feel like there's going to be a healing for? Are they dealing with incredible blessing in their lives that's abundant? And mm-hmm. it's really a time of season of joy. Everyone's kind of coming into this space differently. Mm-hmm. They're all coming in, though. We're going to be gathered. How do we gather them? How do we listen to what God might be speaking that day? How do we respond to God? And then what are we giving them as a gift as they leave? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. it's all about hospitality and generosity. It's about loving our community well and knowing them well, to know what to gift them with, because mm-hmm. nothing's worse than a really bad gift. Like Argyle socks or something, when really, you know, you want to know a person to sure. love them so much. No, that's what we do. We spend so much time keeping our ears on the ground. What's happening in our community? How do we love them well? What do we give them as they leave? There is quite a bit of things that we negotiate in our spaces. And I hope that churches worldwide are also doing the very, very brutal and annoying sometimes work of negotiating many, many things. And we do that mm-hmm. and we think critically about those negotiations. I even think back on this past Wednesday where we had a dynamic African-American preacher in Dwight Radcliffe with traditional silent Japanese tea ceremony all in one service. Mm-hmm. And we spent so much time in our meetings over the course of the last several weeks thinking about how do we go from dynamic, big, animated, full kind of preaching, and how do we take our people from that to a silent, meditative, contemplative practice that is Japanese tea ceremony as communion. There's so many things that we needed to negotiate.
So many things. Absolutely.
So many things. Yeah. We're thinking about tone.
Right.
We're thinking about what is this message holding? Mm-hmm. What is the message in the communion that's found in Japanese tea ceremony? How do we connect those pieces? How do we get a person from that to that to that to that? And we're negotiating every single transition in between. So that doesn't feel like we're throwing people left and right, but that we're just entering in and going through this story together. And so those are the kinds of conversations we're having. I would also say that one of the things that we avoid often and we talk about so that we can avoid it is tokenization and multicultural for multicultural's sake. Mm-hmm. We're not doing it because it's a trend or cool, or we're not even in the business of it because it's right. It's the right thing to do. We're doing it because this is neighborliness. This is hospitality. This is love extravagant. We're thinking about the people that are gathered in the room and online. How do they worship? And could we provide a moment that feels like home to them?
Right.
And the rest of us might need to be uncomfortable for a minute. Mm-hmm. But in order to prefer them in that moment, we're going to feature what they do well and the worship that they bring. What does that contribute to the larger church or the larger knowing of God? We want to feature that for a moment so that person can feel comfortable and at home for that song that we do or for that prayer that we lead. That's important to us. And in that, I really do believe justice is being done actively in an artistic form by loving our neighbor well, doing hospitality in that extreme of a way. I mean, I know that sometimes people come to our services and are uncomfortable, maybe through the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And often we do a lot of the conversations afterwards of what took place. And a lot of those conversations kind of start out rough, where it's, we don't do that in my church, or I don't like that. You know, I don't think we should do worship like that, which unpacks and unpacks. And when we really get to the heart of it and we really talk, a lot of those conversations end with, oh, maybe I need to rethink what hospitality means and what neighborliness means, what loving our neighbors really, really means and what it looks like worked out. And so I spend, I'm sure January and Aaron also spend some time talking to folks that are uncomfortable. But after we have that conversation and they come back, they have a different lens to see the work that we're doing, and they're entering into it a little differently.
Right.
And we're hoping to God that if anything, for the people that get to join us, they get to experience something new that could possibly form them and shape them in ways that maybe worship in their regular Sundays might not be able to do. Mm-hmm. We're praying that that's what's taking place.
I'm Mark Laberton. You're listening to Conversing, a production of Fuller Studio. Well, I think one of the things that's very striking about all of this to me is that, first of all, how significant it is that you just have both the gifts and the willingness to spend time doing this work, because I think it's really important work. I think it, especially if it's going to be generative, and especially if it's going to be communal, and especially if it's going to be creative, it's just not going to be fast, and it's not going to be easy, and it's not going to be quick in any sort of way. It has to steep. It has to go through all kinds of seasons of change. And I can just say, over the years that I've been in this role, and Julie, that you've been in this role, over the years that you've been in this role, there's been such an extraordinary ongoing evolution of what we're now describing today. Mm-hmm. So what we're describing today, I would have said, was more aspirational at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Then now it feels like you're really describing what actually is the case. This is what happens. And we don't think, therefore, we've arrived, but we just would say it's being done authentically and genuinely. So when you use the words that you've been using, they're fair and accurate words. I think the other thing that I want to say that's quite significant to me as I think about the listeners to this is that
because you are working so well together as a team, there's a sense that you really have moved away from one of the greatest pitfalls of public worship, which is an over-awareness and self-consciousness around performance.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that performance isn't in people's minds as worship leaders. Mm-hmm. In fact, I would not want it to not be in your mind.
Right.
It's important that you remember right. that you are actually performing as leaders and that we need you to perform as leaders. But what I mean is that you're free from that kind of self-consciousness as though this is your moment in the light and now it's going to be your featured yes. song mm-hmm. or piece or mm-hmm. whatever it may be. And there's a kind of organic quality to how you put this together that I think does not leave a person who's a worshiper walking away primarily thinking about one of you as right. the performance. I have this, as a preacher, I have that anxiety. I'm not interested in people walking away remembering me as a preacher. I'm interested in people having an encounter with God in the part that I was trying to contribute along with the part that others were trying to mm-hmm. contribute. And in the sum of all that, we have a sense that we've encountered God together. That's the goal. Because your gifts are so strong and the rest of the team has also such strong gifts, it would be easy to imagine an egotistically oriented worship mm-hmm. planning style that can't negotiate except mm-hmm. around whose chance to be in the light is it this week. Mm-hmm. And I've certainly been in plenty of worship settings, as I can only imagine you have been, where you feel like it's sort of set up to be mm-hmm. that person's yeah. moment in the light. And I'm not saying there's no place for that, but it should be scarce, not mm-hmm. primary. And mm-hmm. what I love about the texture of what you all create together is this feeling that it is an act of hospitality. It's, I think, able to be received in that way. So you feel as mm-hmm. though you've created thoughtful preparation for a transformative encounter together and with God. I want to go back to this service that you referred to a minute ago, this week's chapel, where you had an African-American, Dwight Radcliffe, who's one of our beloved friends and a PhD student here at Fuller. Very, very strong and marvelous word of challenge yes. to Fuller and to anybody who was there. And then the movement from that to the tea ceremony leading into communion. Now, for those who are listening to this, this may just seem like the most unlikely, unimaginable thing. But I want to say that one of the things that was so striking to me about it, and I, first of all, I want to say I had complete confidence that this would work.
Yeah.
And I think that's just a statement of how trustworthy you've been mm-hmm. and how faithful you, I knew, would have worked out these details. But the amazing thing was that, as it were, the hat trick, the magic of it all, really unfolded in such a seamless and invisible way that it just felt like, wow, here are these two unlike things that actually can deeply belong together yeah. and did mm-hmm. in a way that it felt, I think, to, I'm guessing, almost everyone there, that it felt like these things really belong as opposed to these two right. things are colliding. Mm-hmm. We've probably all been in worship where it's like a mashup where mm-hmm. people are just taking unlike things and shoving them together yes. in the hope that somehow you're going to mm-hmm. be able to sort it all yourself. Yeah. I think that's potentially fine, I suppose, as a random act. But as a sustained practice of worship, we need to be led in these things. Yes. And I feel like you do that in a really clear but somewhat light-handed and invisible way that doesn't feel like we're being manipulated, coerced, right. forced to do something. Right. And I think all that is really about an attitude of hospitality.
It is, yeah.
What would you say are the things that, if you were to be imagining some people who are listening to this who might be involved as worship leaders or people who are wishing that some of what we're describing here today was more evident in their church, but it may be a more homogeneous group of people, sure. or it may be a place without the, frankly, the amazing array of gifts that you represent mm-hmm. and that others also add to it. Where do they even begin? What are the things that you would think are the most important things? If they were to hold on to maybe two or three of the most important things mm-hmm. in a context where it's not hyperabundance, but yeah. potentially scarcity, what should people be most conscious of trying to hold on to?
Well, some of the conversations that I have pretty regularly when people, I do consults for different churches on how to turn their church into a multicultural space. One, it's very, very slow work. So my first thing that I say is, you got to be so committed. Mm-hmm. I mean, committed to the point where you're willing to lay your body down so that your neighbor can be loved. Mm-hmm. to that point. I mean, it feels very meta, you know, but I'm really serious about that. That's how much it needs to be important to your community to do this work, because it's slow and it's painful, and change comes very hard. It's pain. Human beings, we don't like change. No. So we don't like that. The other thing that I say, which will start meta, but I'll bring it down to earth, is that when I think about God as this enormous being that could not even be fully described by the Bible, and we're in a theological seminary and we study this day and night, and still God is too big and too large. One of the things that I say to friends that are thinking of moving in this direction, the first thing I ask them to accept about God is that God is a mystery. And I feel like, I mean, I'm not a scholar in this or anything, but post-Enlightenment, we kind of lost the wonder and awe of the mystery of God. Mm-hmm. And that's so important to have and to hold in our churches, in our spaces of worship, that when we enter in, we're entering into a space that is so beyond us, and worshiping a God that we know maybe some of, but can't know all of. And we will spend eternity trying to know and maybe God unveiling himself to us through eternity. And it takes an eternity to possibly know this God. And to be able to wonder and awe in that will then start opening up a theology that says that maybe I don't know him all the way. That maybe it might take all these different cultures and all these different liturgies and practices and songs and dance and art to even get a glimpse. That if I were to just stay in my homogenous context, having this narrow view of God, I'm missing out in all the many colors there might be. And so that's what I engage them in. And if God is so vast and so big, it might take the entire universe to try and discover him. And I think so our worship, if we want to move away from it being so narrow, we need to accept the mystery of God, one, that it takes a community of people to do it. And also, even if your context is homogenous, leaning into what other communities might be doing. One of the things that we talk about on Mondays is not so much in the scarcity model, which is to say, I don't have enough, or to be even comparative with other cultures, like they do this and they do that. But it's really a conversation around what is the abundance we see in our communities, and what do these communities have to
within
offer?
Within any given congregational setting.
Yes.
Yeah.
What do we have? What are we bringing? It's not thinking about in terms of like, what don't you have? But it's all it's all about what do you have and what are you bringing to this?
Right.
And how can this contribute to us all searching and trying to discover this God and to know this God? And how do we worship him in all of the vibrance there is together?
Yes.
So even if you are in a homogenous context, imagine what you can know and learn from Coptic Christians in Egypt. Imagine what you could be learning about God out of the story and out of the pain and the triumph in through the African-American story. What could we learn from the lament and painstaking, chest-beating kind of worship and prayer that emerges out of the Korean context? All these things are helping us to know God in a different way. And that can only really just contribute to a more exciting worship. And a more
abundant worship.
Abundant worship. A worship that isn't scarce, but is like, oh my gosh, overflowing.
What would either of you add?
I think there's a necessity in every community to see worship as an opportunity to cultivate an awareness of one another.
Right.
And I think that happens regardless of how multicultural the space is. So the first chapel I came to at Fuller, I remember the moment that I was like, oh, I like this, was when there was a song that was sung in a language I didn't understand. Because I knew that that was attending to somebody else's need. And so rather than approaching the space of worship as it's just me and God and I just need to get what I need to get.
Yes.
I am approaching the space of saying it is me and these brothers and sisters. And I need to be aware of them and what their needs are.
Right.
Because I think that's the critique that you see oftentimes when it comes to the worship of Christians in the Bible and the worship, the critiques of the prophets in the Old Testament is you come to God, but you forget your brother and sister.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You come to worship me, but you don't remember the needs mm-hmm. of the people next to you. So how do you remember those needs? Mm-hmm. And I think that we do this in interesting ways because, you know, so one of the generational ones that always comes up is like hymns versus contemporary songs or something silly like this. And then we're like, well, we'll just separate them and have two different services. Yeah. As opposed to saying, no, you're going to need to cultivate a patience. Mm-hmm. This is what it means to be discipled into Christ and mm-hmm. into Christ's body that is diverse. Mm-hmm. Like you will have to sit here and mm-hmm. it is your expression of love to be here mm-hmm. while we do something for your neighbor. Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right, right.
And that is your worship to God.
Yes.
Right.
To embrace that moment and to participate in that yeah. moment for their behalf.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And then I believe that there should be a reciprocity or some mm-hmm. kind of moment where mm-hmm. they mm-hmm. also say, and because you're here.
Yes.
And because I know this is what you need, I hope you get this.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know what I mean? Like, so I mentioned that there's certain progressions, there's certain sounds that matter mm-hmm. to me. Mm-hmm. I don't expect I'm going to hear those every time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because those matter to me. I would love for my neighbor to one day say, Aaron, we did this because we know that this is mm-hmm. what you need. Mm-hmm. This is what restores okay. you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then there are other Sundays that I need to go in and say, what does somebody else here need?
Right.
I think it's that awareness and love for one another, mm-hmm. that we're not coming to God as individuals, mm-hmm. but as a community.
Yeah.
So how do we wait for one another?
Right, right.
How do we
right.
express patience?
Incredibly
and I think
important.
Every worship yeah. leader has the opportunity mm-hmm. to cultivate mm-hmm. that. You know, like, even if you have a church where you just get in there and it's just bumping the whole time, you right. know, like,
yeah.
and people are pumped, they're excited. Is there a member of your congregation that really needs a moment of silence? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And could you instruct your congregation and say, hey, this isn't what we always do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
But there are a few people here who need this.
Right.
Can we join in that with mm-hmm. them? Yeah. I think that's the thing. That
yeah, and I would mean. Add to that in saying that I think the job of worship leaders is to help form the people that are with you in that space and to form them in such a way that you move them from being uncomfortable to just tolerating something yeah. that's different to a point where maybe those chord progressions that meant so much to Aaron, I have now adopted it and right. it's in my body too.
Right.
And I'm starting to sense right. what he means by that. It's mm-hmm. I'm owning that now. It's mm-hmm. it's becoming part of me as well.
Right.
And it's forming me. Mm-hmm. That's how you know that you have really shaped somebody when things that might have been different, like our space always juggles English, Korean, and Spanish, and songs mm-hmm. coming out of those contexts are part of our normal repertoire. In the beginning, it's just, oh, it's kind of different. I'm kind of uncomfortable mm-hmm. until we sing it again. And then it's like, oh, I tolerate this. I remember the melody. I don't quite know if I can sing these words yet, but I remember the melody to a point where now you're in it. When you hear that first chord mm-hmm. strike, you are up there. Your hands yeah. are raised. You're in it. You have adopted the song as mm-hmm. your own.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We need mm-hmm. to do the work, and it's slow work again, where it doesn't happen over just a couple times of singing that song mm-hmm. or just a couple times of doing this. It really takes time, but you want to carry your community
yeah.
to a point where it gets to that mm-hmm. because something's going to change in the person.
Right, that's the transformative work.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And I think this is where worship begins to really intersect with the work of justice.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Because now worship is training you to be more aware of your neighbor.
Yes.
Right.
It's not a place where you go to forget
to
your neighbor.
Right. Neighbor, right.
And
right.
not to just tolerate
and
them.
Not even to tolerate mm-hmm. them, right. but to learn right. how to love them.
Love them.
Mm-hmm. Right, mm-hmm. right.
I mean, it's such a difficult call. Like, I definitely want to address that mm-hmm. because I think my number one fear coming out of, you know, my given time at Fuller Chapel was to go into a local church context and be this judgmental kind of like, you're not doing worship the way God intended it to kind of work. Because there's always that fear of walking into a Sunday context
right.
now.
Absolutely.
Because what we experience here on a weekly basis, I'm recognizing it's not the norm mm-hmm. and it's not at all a given. Mm-hmm. And so for me to be blessed on a weekly basis here to help plan and help lead and to enter into a place where it's not like that at all, it's not a priority. It's a difficult struggle. It's a difficult mm-hmm. tension mm-hmm. to kind of balance out mm-hmm. personally for mm-hmm. myself. And so I think even a good caution for myself, for me to tell my own spirit is, you don't have the right answers, January. Mm-hmm. You're exploring and you're discovering and you're trying things, right? Mm-hmm. But ultimately, at the end of the day, I do not, let's just because I have more experience doesn't make me so much more deeper than anybody mm-hmm. else who plans another worship in a more homogenous setting.
Right.
And their struggles are mm-hmm. probably something that I will not understand. Mm-hmm. Just like my mm-hmm. struggles, nobody will completely understand mm-hmm. either. And
right.
so in that, I think a practical way of approaching the table is just having a space to get, again, dialogue and to share and to collaborate. We've been really like hitting that collaborative spirit an awful lot in this room, but many churches or many local contexts, it's like you have the one worship leader and then that's usually the head pastor. And then that entire person is responsible for like 300 people or 800 people, or thousands of people. That's a lot of pressure. And of course, you're going to have to stick to a structure because you're doing so many things at once. But what about if you started building a team of diverse voices and you were intentional about the fact that I'm going to share this platform with these people and I'm going to actually relate to the people in my neighborhood. And like Aaron said, like I'm going to invite, like Julie said, the people to this table whose voices are usually not highlighted on a given Sunday context in this society, in this space. And so for me, I think it really starts with this acknowledgement of like, we do not know enough. We actually don't have the right answers. The pressure isn't about finding the perfect worship setting, but maybe, like I said, providing people the opportunity to continue to explore that on a weekly basis that's both rotational and also highlights the voices that have been muted in, say, the past. And I think one last thing I want to just address is that for me, I come specifically from a Korean American local church context where, you know, I mean, I love this church to death, but we sing, we're like a cover band, right? We sing a lot of famous Christian songs and all that. And it really hits the people in the congregation. People are so blessed by worship and so great. We are doing our job, right? But it strikes me that as Korean Americans, 99% of this demographic is Korean American, we don't think to sing a Korean song. Isn't that an interesting thing? We don't even think to sing a Korean song where our parents speak this language, where we've grown up speaking Korean, and yet to our God, we cannot sing in our heart language. It doesn't even strike us to sing that. There's a poignancy in that for me. There's a heartbreak in that. There is a bridge that has been shattered somewhere down the first generation, second generation, that requires healing. And for church leaders to really recognize that, we need actually to start with healing. And we need to address that even in our singular culture, there's stuff that is so broken that we actually have to address in order to even get somewhere else. I think that's very important.
I think it's funny to say that actually if your Korean-American church does a song in Korean, it would actually be multicultural. Because our parents' generation is a different culture. They're an immigrant population. We're second gen, so our first gen would be immigrant. And so their native language or tongue would be Korean. We're Korean American. We're this sort of dual universe of one this, one that mixture. I don't even know sometimes how to describe that experience. I'd say an exilic experience, maybe. So it would be actually your church, if they did a song in Korean that your parents sing on a Sunday, that would literally be multicultural. It's like one step in, you know? Mark, can we ask you a question?
Sure.
I think one of the things that maybe doesn't get talked a lot about, but you kind of mentioned earlier about preaching. For a lot of evangelical spaces, preaching is this, it's the ritual moment in the service. But the way that you described it earlier, it's not always for you. That's not the goal. The goal isn't for your preaching to be the climactic point in the service, but really that you're part of the entity that's creating something with the rest of what's happening and you're kind of contributing as well. This is the gift that you're bringing. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, I know that there's a classic, especially Reformed vision of worship in which the proclaimed word is really the seen as the high point of the worship. And the theology that's behind that is not trying to elevate the preacher, but really the voice of God to the community of people. And I accept that. I think that that's a really important part of preaching. And I do think that that's part of what I'm attempting to do. However, I'm also very aware that there is exposition, there's reflection, there is preaching that happens in the service in many other forms, in addition to what's happening through the sermon. So I see the sermon as being a legitimate and a very, very important part of worship to me. And at the same time, I think, yes, but I'm being preached to and I'm hearing the voice of God and I'm encountering the word of God in many, many different ways over the course of the service. So I don't feel as though the preaching stands really almost by itself like the diamond in a setting where everything has been the setup for the sermon. I think there are services where that is what happens and where when it does happen and it's the right thing, it can actually be an extraordinary thing. I don't think it's the normative picture of what worship has to be. The normative picture is that God is speaking to us, has spoken and is speaking. That to me is the center of worship. And that will probably many times involve the place of the proclaimed word, but it also involves all the other things, the authentic witness of a community over time through music, song, prayer, the arts in various ways. I mean, I'm often in settings where thing that I have the hardest time about worshiping in those settings is that, especially when they're more low church and contemporary, is that it's as though I've been asked to worship through the personality of the worship leader. That does not help me. I don't want to worship through their personality. I want to allow them to invite me and us into an encounter of God, but I didn't come to have an encounter with you per se, right? That's not really my reason for being here. And I remember a very dark time in my life when I was also in a period of change and I was in a different setting than I had been living in. And I was trying to find a church that I could worship. And it felt as though every place that I went had, as it were, the great band, let's say, but it all felt like it was an introduction to really having to encounter them. And if I could get over that, then I had a chance at meeting God. And I ended up going during that year to a very high liturgical service. And I realized that what I wanted was the hospitality that you were describing earlier that can come in many different ways. It can even be embodied in the same songs, the same leaders. It might be high church, low church. That varies, and I'm sort of Episcopal-Presbycostal, so I'm quite comfortable across an incredible range. I don't have any particular need for it having to be a certain style. But what I want is to encounter God together in community.
Right.
A God who has spoken, is still speaking, is calling to us for healing and mercy and grace and truth and justice and life change and relational healing and renewal, all the things that God is doing in the world. And when that feast is being set and I'm being invited as a part of a community to encounter God in that way, then I think my own defenses drop away. I think other people's defenses drop away. We're prepared to let the first thing be first and not the second, third, fourth, or fifth thing become first, which then only perpetuates our confused worship, which is the story of our lives on any given day, right? I mean, that's the problem. So corporate worship is meant to be the corrective to disordered worship. So we come in from the cycle of our week where we've been disoriented, and then we want to get reordered. So in the Reformed tradition, the heart of that is thought to be what happens through the proclaimed word. I think it happens through the word, but I think the word comes to us in many manifestations, and that we should always be subservient to that. But that's different than being subservient, as it were, to a sermon, which can sometimes be an idolatry of preaching in a way that, or a near idolatry, which I think is a distortion. I think that's not really what the best, even Reformed theology would argue for. But it does mean that there's an authority to this experience that's not just driven by my appetite, my taste, my desires,
right?
I'm entering into a context where God is the reorderer of things, and I need and seek that reordering. So there's an authority quite literally over and against me, as well as an authority in me, through me, beside me, under me, behind me, with me, right? All of that is happening at the same time. So one of the things that I think I find so meaningful about your leadership and worship together as a team is this sense that I don't, as I said, feel as though you're inviting us into worship through you. I think there's very little actual personality evident, which is quite amazing given that you are so wonderfully divergent from each other.
We're so extra.
You are so eccentric.
That's a good way to put it.
And I love that. I love that's why I can trust you, because you're not homogenous and you're going to be your own unique selves. I want you to be that. But then I sort of don't want to have to look at it straight on. I want to be able to sort of see it sideways. And I think that's what you do, which then allows God to be present. I remember once worshiping in a church where there was a choir that came out in its robes and occupied all the central part of the chancel. And I was with a Roman Catholic friend who, you would never see that in a Roman Catholic church. And he said, "Oh my gosh, this is so strange. Like, did we come here to worship the choir?" And I think I didn't ever see it that way, but it was clear to me that he was just reading the architecture, right? I guess that must be it. We've come to, because obviously in a Roman Catholic church, it would be the altar that would be central.
Exactly.
It would not be the choir. You would never see them in front. Yeah. That's not. But the same thing can happen in the low church tradition. Where did I come to worship the band?
Yeah.
To which the answer is sometimes yes. Yeah. I mean, especially in churches where music is potentially an idol,
that's right. Mm-hmm.
Then it really does feel like, oh my gosh, I came to hear them do that mm-hmm. amazing song where so-and-so does such and such. That's it's understandable as performance, but that's slightly different than I think what we've obviously been talking about. Yeah.
There are a couple of things that really came to mind that I think are essential. And I think part of the reason that we've been able to avoid that is the first question we ask when we set up isn't, what are we going to do? Mm-hmm. The first question that I think we always try to ask is, what is it that the people of God are going to do?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And how do we facilitate that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's a hugely different question.
And so that means that it might be that we're like, oh, we'll lead them in this song.
Right.
Mm-hmm. This seems appropriate. But that might not be it.
Yeah. Sure.
It could be what the people of God need is this moment of silence. What the people of God need is this corporate prayer. And that's always the first question is, what do these folks need?
Right.
To the point where I think that, at least for me, I could say my proudest moment was a moment that I was not involved in. I had asked, and I felt like there needed to be a moment to deal with both silence and hope and despair at once. Mm-hmm. And the only thing I could think to do was to have one of our chapel assistants, Josh, sing by himself a song with a lot of rest and put his voice out there. And then watch the room as they hear his voice in this space of vulnerability, join into that vulnerability with them, hearing one another.
Right.
I had nothing to do with that. I played bass. Like it was 60 bars of rest for me.
Yeah.
Right.
Like,
But it wasn't about me having opportunity. Right. I wasn't thinking, what can I do to make that happen? Right. I was thinking, what is in the room that makes this moment available for us?
Right. Right.
That's the question.
Totally.
That I think kind of helped. That I think continually helps us as a team reorient from just drawing attention towards ourselves.
Well, I think it's one of the most distinctive qualities of the worship that all of you lead is this feeling that you're leading us, but we're not actually primarily absorbed with you.
Yeah.
And and it does feel as though it's been created for us to come together in the presence of God.
Yeah.
It's really remarkable. I would love to continue this conversation, but I just want to say thank you so much for what you've been doing at Fuller. And extend that as a thanks to your wider team. And I do want to say, Julie, especially my gratitude to you, because I think really the legacy that you stepped into is a complicated legacy, like a chapel is at any school. That was certainly true at here. And it took, I think, an understandable kind of flexibility, which I think you've displayed in some pretty remarkable ways. And you're not self-serving, so your team is not self-serving, so the chapel is not self-serving. And that just ends up being a glory to God. So thank you to you, Julie, but thank you to all of you.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a production of Fuller Studio. Fuller Studio provides articles, podcasts, videos, and other resources for a deeply formed spiritual life. Subscribe on your favorite podcast app or visit us at fuller.edu/studio.